to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, returning today to a perennial theme of ours, perennial, unfortunately, because it's always salient, and that's the state of California, or maybe we should say the state of the state of California, where you live, where I'm from. And let's start today with that recurring feature of late summer, early fall in California, which is wildfires and heat waves. And if you were to go solely by national media coverage of this phenomenon, you could be forgiven for believing that this is entirely a function of climate change and that the state of California is more or less helpless to do anything in the face of the outbreaks. As a lifelong Californian, how well does that account?
Oh, I don't think anybody believes that here in California, because any of us who grew up remember going in the Sierra National Forest or Sequoia National Park or Yosemite, and there were logging roads crisscrossing those mountainsides. So when you had a drought, and there were many of them, gosh, I lived in the 76-77 drought. It was bad as a 2014 almost. But they cut down trees and they cleared the brush. And you could see actual forest rangers. They would have tractors and spring tubes behind them pulling out stuff. That was the idea, that you had to kind of tidy up the forest. And then came, well, who's the forest for? It's not to make wood for our homes. It's not to have a bunch of guys on snowmobiles or jet skis go to a lake. It's not to go camp out. It's not for people. It's for nature. So fires are good, and they clean up periodically. They thin out the dead trees. And what's a national forest, like where I have a house in Huntington Lake? It's for basically a guy in Palo Alto or, I don't know, Malibu, who's pretty well off, and he likes to commune with nature for a week or two, and he backpacks, and he doesn't want to see anybody. And then he goes home, and he votes for all sorts of road cancellations and no more logging. And that's what happened. And everybody had warned about it. If you go back and look at the 2014 drought, almost every day there's a major article saying this is going to be a disaster. We have 1 or 2 years to harvest 60, 70, 80 million dead trees that were either killed by the drought or weakened and the bark beetle destroyed them. And they're going to be green napalm if we ever have a fire. And we had fires. Where I was 2 years ago, there was the Aspen fire, a huge fire. There was a huge paradise last year, and everybody warned them. And I don't know whether it was just pure ideology or the state that has the highest tax basket in the country is broke. So, but it was convenient, wasn't it, for the Greens to tell the governors, Brown and Newsom, it's much better not to spend any money on forest cleanup, and then for them to say, yeah, we don't have any money, so we'll just not go in there and cut those things. And then I got kind of scared, because in March, April, as the snow began to melt, I would go up to the Sierra. There was a panic almost about insurance companies were pulling out. They were no longer. I got a note and said, you have 5 days to either double your premiums or we're canceling your insurance. Everybody did. And they thought, you know what? This is now out of hand. These trees are no longer good for logging. We waited too long. They're rotting and they're falling over on, you know, across trails. We got to go. And so they started mass cutting in the Sierra, and they were hoping they could beat the fire season, which traditionally starts in late August. But they couldn't get the stuff out. They cut it up and they put it in kind of like funeral pyre square boxes so they could burn it when the snow came. And the point I'm making is that when this thing hit, it was tinderbox. So I've talked to a lot of people in the fire service and law enforcement about this the last 2 weeks, and they all say if we had not had the dead trees at the rate of we did, we could have handled it, because they'll say the big fire would sweep through and then it would singe all the branches or the needles off a cedar or a sugar pine, but it wouldn't ignite it if it was green and lush. But it would not only ignite, it would blow apart a six-year-old tree that was, you know, dry, and not only dead but dry for 6 years. It would just blow them apart and send kind of like Molotov cocktails over the roof of the forest. Everybody knows that. And so we all know that what happens now in California in late summer is we get a fire, and it's because we don't graze the hillsides with cattle. We don't clear the brush. We don't allow logging. And then we have a left-wing official saying this is all because of climate change and we need more solar panels and more subsidized high-speed rail. And it used to work, but I don't think anybody believes it anymore. They all know what's going on. And they also, there's another thing that people don't talk about. It's kind of like the protest that we saw that some people got to protest and break the quarantine and some didn't. So there was a gender outing group that was letting off virtual fireworks in the dry hillside. Why was that ever allowed? And it's pretty common knowledge where we are here that there's a lot of marijuana farms up in the Sierra. A lot of people illegally from Mexico up in the Sierra with drugs, as well as so-called hippies. And they're not vigorously going after them in the way that they used to. Some of them use very deadly chemicals as well for herbicides and fertilizers and stuff. So there's an idea that, well, we have some non-traditional people in the forest, but we're not really going to go root them out. And so that was a problem, but it wasn't climate change. I have seen all sorts of droughts and forest fires, and it was a state with 40 million people that did not want to clean their forest up. And the government had spent the money on other things that were not essential and said they were broke. And so then they dressed up that bankruptcy by saying, oh, it was climate change, not us.
Another factor that's been at work this summer is a phrase that will bring goosebumps to anyone who lived in California during the early 2000s, and that's rolling blackouts. And it's been sort of amazing to watch Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, react to these with a certain kind of outrage, as if these are totally unpredictable acts of God. In reality, if you understand the way that energy policy works in California, this starts to make a lot more sense. So explain what that looks like.
Well, we have, I think, the fourth largest reserves of natural gas, and we were the pioneer in nuclear power. So say 2 hours from where I'm sitting, Diablo Canyon is about 50 years old, and it produces clean, safe electricity. It's going to be shut down now. It's not going to be re-energized with new fuel. And during the Gray Davis brownouts, before the climate hysteria, we built a lot of the up-to-date, more natural gas. And then we started to say, you can't frack, and we cut back natural gas. And the result of it is, and then we started subsidizing wind and solar. And you see these farms everywhere. Everybody has panels. I have panels. Okay. But the problem with all of this is that when it's smoky and a forest fire, my panel generation went down by 70% because I'm looking out the window and it looks like a winter foggy day. There's no sunlight. And so what happened was we had to do two things. We needed more energy because the temperatures climbed, as they always do in late August. You're in Selma, right? I'm looking out the window at Selma. It's 108 last week. You want your air conditioning, you turn it on. Everybody turns it on. And guess what? The state has no power. And so they have to either have a rolling blackout, or they have to buy electricity from coal-producing plants in places like Utah, or they have to tell the lake that 10 or 12% of our power is old-fashioned hydroelectric, which they kind of sneer at. It's the cleanest power there is, but they kind of sneer at it because it requires alteration of the environment with a dam. And so what happened is, I'll give you an example. In Huntington Lake, they said, you know what, we're going to drain the lake before Labor Day. And we're sorry, we need this hydroelectric. We're going to run the Big Creek Power Project at full capacity, 110%, because of this heat wave. And then all of a sudden, guess what? The fire broke out, the smoke came, the solar panel and wind farms were not very good. They didn't produce things at night. And we had rolling blackouts, and then the forest policy destroyed the power. And now that lake is filling up because they don't have any electricity to open up the gates for the pent to open the gates to generate it, because everything is burned and the infrastructure is ruined. So the lake, if you go up there, it's going, you can see pictures, it's going over the top of the dam. So it's a multi, what I'm getting at, it's kind of a multi-system breakdown. As one guy said to me, he had a mask on. I was talking to him at the doctor's office, and he said, do you have the mask on because you're afraid of COVID? Or do you have the mask on because you can't breathe the smoky air? Or you have the mask on because you're one of the criminals everybody let out? They let out 20,000 people without, you know, that were in prison jails. So that's what we're talking about in California, which Michael Bloomberg said is the future we'd all like to have.
I have a close friend who ran for office in California a long time ago, decades ago. And he was a native Californian, but a Californian who had spent a lot of his political career in D.C. And for that reason, the issue that was the hardest for him to get his head around, and indeed, I think the one that it's difficult for a lot of non-Westerners to understand the importance of, is water. But this is so central to public policy in California and such a flashpoint there. Can you explain why water policy plays such a major role in the state?
Well, this is a huge state, and you know, it's 800 miles long. And unfortunately or fortunately, two-thirds of the people live in the Central Valley and the coast and the LA Basin area in San Diego, where only one-third of the precipitation falls. And where two-thirds fall in the northern half of the northern third of the state in the Sierra Nevada mountains, the two-thirds where the precipitation snow is, only one-third or less than that live. So we knew that. And so, you know, visionaries like Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's dad, they created two projects, the Central Valley Federal Project and the California Water Project, and they brought massive amounts of water out of, you know, Lake Shasta and Orville Dam, and they brought it all the way to the Bay Area. It's about 70% of Stanford University's water is California Water Project, along with what comes in from Hetch Hetchy from Yosemite. And everybody knew it. And it worked great until they warned us around 1980, hey, this project was designed for a state of 16 million, you got 20 million people. You're going to have shortages. And then then the Jerry Brown administration said, you know what, that's not natural, white water. And then we had Gray Davis and then the legislature, and they overruled Wilson and Dick Majan. And so the point is, we didn't build any more reservoirs. We didn't build any more water transference. And then we had our normal 8 or 9 year gap, we'd have a bad drought. And they dried up. We wouldn't have water. We wouldn't have hydroelectric. We wouldn't have recreation. We wouldn't have irrigation water. Everybody went nuts. And they said, it's climate change. And we might have a half a degree in California over 88 years or 90 years. I've been reading the data. Even that's somewhat unclear given the record problem, paucity of records. But we have a person problem where we didn't keep up with population. And then we brought in a lot of people from foreign countries that were impoverished, that were not aware of the need for infrastructure. And they came into a very affluent society, and they didn't understand that if you have enormous Medi-Cal overruns, or you had California pensioners, or whatever the reason is, and you were not investing in freeways and dams and aqueducts and penstocks, then this beautiful utopia could turn hostile. It could go rogue and savage on you, feral, and it did. So what we need to do is, you know, we got to say, look, if you got a fire engine and you want to get up from Fresno up to Huntington Lake or Shaver Lake or Edison, you need a good road. We don't need to stop the road in 1970 and say, you know, now it's the Kaiser Wilderness area and you can't, there's no road to get up there to Edison or Florence. And so the roads are bad. There's not infrastructure. The policies are bad. And then we have no margin of error. So when we hit a drought, bang. If we hit an earthquake, bang. If we hit a wildfire, bang. And we have mass civilization disruption. And the $64,000 question is, will the emerging Mexican-American middle class, which constitutes about 40% of the population, will they say, you know what, this is kind of condescending and even racist on the part of this Bay Area, Silicon Valley, Malibu elite? They have all the money, they have all the power, and they want to live in utopia, but we bear the consequences of their ideology. So they live in 70 degrees, we live in 100 degrees, we want air conditioning and cheap, affordable power. We like to go up to the lake because we don't have enough money, you know, to have a seaside home, or we don't have a money like Pelosi to live in Napa. We don't live in Pacific Heights like Dianne Feinstein. But if we can't get to the lake because it's burning up, you should have seen the caravan on Saturday. My son said it was the most incredible thing he ever see. He went up there and he had to turn around. He almost got caught. There were thousands of poor Mexican-American people fleeing the 108-degree weather to go to Shaver Lake. And that was their big vacation for the entire month they planned. They had food. They had going to have a great time in the cool weather. And they all were stuck in a 105-degree traffic jam trying to flee the fire. And it was completely avoidable, and it was sort of a aristocratic symptom of what's wrong with this medieval society of two different classes, a large underclass and I guess it's called a gentry or a clerisy on the coast. But they do a lot of damage to people, and they call it morality.
On that infrastructure note that you just sounded, one of the things that's striking to me, as a Californian who loves his home state and in many ways wishes he was back there despite all this dysfunction that you're identifying, is to sit here in the New York City area where I am and witness the New York envy you see in California sometimes. And what I mean by that is that amongst a certain stripe of California elites, there is a real longing for New York-style density in housing and in transportation. There's an increasingly explicit wish that people would just get off the road and give up their cars. And the monument to that vision, as you mentioned earlier, is what little has been constructed of the state's infamous high-speed rail project. So tell us about what that looks like today and what broader truths it illuminates about infrastructure in California.
Yeah, Laura Logan of Fox Nation, I think, is having a series on that. And she came here, and she and I drove over there. It's about 10 miles from my house, and it's like nothing. It's reminds me of supposedly the Potemkin villages under the Tsarina Catherine, because at every major highway or freeway, they've done a overpass, and they have all these signs and posters, your high-speed rail bonds at work. And then you leave this little Potemkin veneer, and you start to follow it, and there's nothing. I mean, the land is barren. They have right away, apparently, but they haven't surveyed it. They haven't cleared it. They haven't built anything because they're broke. And when even the cranes that are so visible, and people were used to scurry around while you drove to work every day to Fresno, there's nobody there. There may be one or two maintenance people. So they're broke. And the sad thing is not just that they blew 13 or 14 billion. It's what they could have spent with the 13, 14. So they could have made a 6-lane freeway from LA up to Sacramento, the 99, and it would have been safe. And now it remains the most dangerous highway per miles driven freeway. It's not even a freeway, shouldn't use that, of any major thoroughfare in the United States. Or they could have finished the Sites Reservoir or the Los Banos Grandes Reservoir or the Temperance Flat and gained another 10 million acre feet of water. Or they could have done all of that. Or they could have cleaned up the forest for $5 billion and allowed logging to go, and we could have revived the timber industry. And what's really galling about this is that, so when you go up to Palo Alto and you drive through Woodside, or you go up to Portola Valley, or you drive up to Presidio Heights in San Francisco, or you go up to Napa or Calistoga, and you see where these people live, it's the weirdest thing. Or you go to the Tesla dealership, it's amazing. They have hilltop estates. They don't want to live in high rises. They like Jaguars especially, but Mercedes, Audi, Tesla. I go to their homes sometimes, and believe me, they are beautiful wood floors. They have granite counters. They have stainless. It's very tasteful. In other words, they like detached living. They like to be on the freeway in their own super car, super-powered car, whatever they think it is. They love private schools. They don't like the public schools. They put their they fight to get their kids in 6 or 7 prep schools. They name drop. I can't talk to a left-wing billionaire or millionaire without them saying, you know, my son is at Stanford this year. Oh, I was really disappointed. You know, he went to New Haven, or he went to Cambridge. And you're supposed to say, Cambridge means Harvard. You mean New Haven means Yale? So they're most pretentious, snobby people. And so what I'm getting at with this Wendy explanation is I think all of this stuff that they do is part of, you know, a medieval sinner's buying one block on the Dome of St. Peter's or Renaissance sinner so he can continue to sin as penance or expiation, because believe me, they do not want to get crammed into mass transit and see people, you know, go lawless as we've seen in New York, or they do not want to walk into their high-rise building and climb over the homeless on the sidewalk. Their idea is we're going to Zoom or Skype from home and with our beautiful view, and we're going to get on the freeway to a good hour, and we can drive in a very nice sports car, and we want everybody else to live in high rises and take mass transit because that's very green and economical. It's kind of like the Soviet elite with their competing Dakas on the shores of the Crimea.
Final question for you. You wrote about California recently in an article at National Review, which you ended on a fairly dour note. You don't have a lot of faith that anything is going to change in California anytime soon. And you're certainly not alone on that. So maybe I'm grasping at straws here, Victor, but is there anything in California in the year 2020 that gives you even the faintest flicker of hope, some outside chance that something somewhere could arrest the slide?
Well, put it
this way. You can take as much time as you like.
Yeah. When I talk like you and I are talking, I don't get very far with people in the Stanford community where I work. But I do get really far with people out here. And that is what's striking. If I talk to a local city councilman, or if I talk to a highway patrolman, or if I talk to a sheriff, or I talk to a guy in a tractor, that, even though it's kind of altered from the past immigrant experience when I grew up with Armenians and Greeks and Japanese and Portuguese, this new emerging Mexican-American lower and middle class, they want affordable electricity. They want affordable gas. They want timber. They are action people, and they want to, you know, get up and go out and get them. They don't like the smug, oh, well, you know, we can't do this, we can't do this, we can't do that. They came here to build something for a better life. And they're starting to see that, you know, they'll say, why is gas so expensive here? Why can't we turn on our air conditioners? Why is food so expensive? Why is all this stuff? And I'll say, I don't know. You guys voted for them. You tell me. Oh, did I vote for them? I said, yes. And they said, well, you know, they were for this or that. It's usually for big government or redistribution policies. But now that they're no longer poor, as most immigrants begin, they're starting to emulate the Italian-American experience, say, from 1920 to 1970, where, as I said earlier, you look at an Italian-American, Cuomo and Giuliani, you can't predict his political persuasions by his last name. And that's happening, I think, to the Mexican-American community. I don't know if it's going to be in time for 2020, but I think it will have a role. But that's my sense of optimism, that they are going to be the new conservative Democrat working class that we used to have. And there's one other thing, Troy, and that is, culturally, I don't think that these people in Antifa quite understand how they appear to others. I don't mean their political agendas or their socialism or their violence. I'm talking about their mannerisms, their nasal tone voice, and their schizophrenia about making fun of policemen or using profanity or using violence. And then when they're arrested and they're put on the ground and they put those little plastic temporary handcuffs, they squeal and they yell, you can't do this, I'm getting my lawyer, where's the police, I need the police for somebody. And that doesn't come off well to working people. And so that's the Democrats' problem. They've got all of these elites, and they condescendingly, it's not that they say things like you ain't black, but they just assume that people, because they share their liberal philosophies, they like them. They like how they look, how they talk, how they act toward people. And they don't. They think, you know what? These people are snobs. They're arrogant. I don't like it. They're not versatile people. They're, I don't want to say they're wimps. I don't know if they are or not, but there's a cultural divide that's growing. And I don't think the left is realized. Those people that are screaming on MSNBC, no matter what ethnic background, I don't think they understand how they come off to working class people of all races. And I do think that's one of the great fears and hatreds of Donald Trump, because I think I don't know if he's thought it out, but he's groping empirically, hit and miss, but he's starting to get the idea that, boy, you talk about class, that is a fluid concept, and race is not. And so if you can say to people of different races, we're all here as Americans and we're all going to be middle class, that's something that the Democratic Party are saying, no, if you're LeBron or you're Oprah or you're Barack, you're still, you may be a multimillionaire, billionaire, but you're still oppressed because you're black. And I think that's one of the reasons they're terrified of this Trump movement, because he's redefining America by class rather than permanent racial categorization. And not even like you're in the lower middle class, so you're exploited, but more like you're in the lower middle class and this is America, it's not Europe, so we're going to get you in the upper middle class, and don't apologize for it. And that's why I think all the hatred is, that this is a very revolutionary movement that Trump is trying to pull off. I don't know if he's articulated it, but it's nothing like John McCain or Mitt Romney. What's ironic is that the people who hate him so much, and they say, we need the Bushes back, or we need Romney back, these are polite gentlemen. There was a legitimate criticism of Republicans that they were elitist and golf course people. And so it's kind of ironic that liberals like people that were aristocratic, or at least more aristocratic than Trump.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.